When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OSEAMalibu.com, code MOM.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, simply everything you can possibly think of, has its own history, like stigmata, tomatoes, and intolerance.
Oh, I think intolerance is an interesting one, Sam. Very interesting. It's quite a serious one, the history of intolerance. Tolerance and intolerance. Or we could do lows, blows and flows. Slows, and we've already done something on gin. Slows, meadows, or the rhyme almost works, or hose. And with hose, I'm thinking more here garden implement or item of clothing than the subject of a Big Daddy Kane rap. That's a sort of esoteric reference for all the... All those history types of you among our listeners. However, this is to digress as ever, because we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining very carefully indeed how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew that the history of grandparents is in fact all about World War II, oral history and sociability during lockdown. It's also about 20th century New Zealand, memory and identity, National Grandparents' Day, Elizabeth Freke and the tragic death of a grandson. It's also about monarch's grandfathers, Chinese relatives, as well as my own great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents and the Norman Conquest. Who knew? Or who knew, for example, that the history of leaving home is in fact not just simply about the Viking invasions, which is one of our excellent homeschooling episodes, but it's also about 17th century boys attending school and university, mothers home to letters. It's about going off to war, travelling around the world. It's the opposite of staying at home during lockdown and being under house arrest. So, who knew, Sam?
I love what we do. It's just brilliant.
It is nuts, isn't it?
Indeed, who did know that? You're all probably wondering who is telling you all of this information. My fellow presenter, let me say that if history itself were a doll, this man would build her a house to live in, complete with everything that history needed to be comfortable, happy, and not vindictively wanting to corrupt the past, as it would if imprisoned in a miserable dungeon of antiquity, convulsed with shivering loneliness. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is Professor James Daber.
Hello.
Hello, James.
Hello. And you may well indeed be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a doll-related historian, he'd only be the action man doll of the history world, scaling the heights of history, the Ken doll of the past, charming his way through the archives with such plasticized swagger, the Buzz Lightyear of 21st century history making. I could go on, but you've probably already guessed that it is the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis. I was particularly pleased with the Ken doll charming his way through the archives with plasticised swagger.
I was going to pick up on it myself, James. The phrase plasticised swagger is not one I've come across
before. No, me neither.
Possibly no one else in the history of the world has come across the phrase plasticised swagger. Anyway, thank you very much. I'm delighted with that. Ladies and gentlemen, we are doing the history of dolls, suggested by none other than James Daybell.
Yes, and so I suppose that's my cue to say, why did I think of it? which I don't know. I don't know. I mean, we've sort of talked about dolls in some way in the past. We've talked about dolls' houses. We've talked about puppets, which you could think of as dolls. I am the father of two lovely daughters, and the house was awash with dolls. There is a tub full of dolls, but they don't get used anymore. But I think dolls have a fascinating history. And I was trying to get away from the sort of straight history of the doll, which I'm sure you could trace back to the Viking Age. I mentioned the Vikings, and I remember in our book on the Vikings, we had a chapter on toys. And I think there was some stuff on dolls in that. So you could have a look at the history of dolls, but also you could have a look at dolls in really interesting ways. And one of the things that I'm going to be talking about is actually mannequins. So, the history of mannequins, dolls that were, you know, used to display fashion. Or we could think about automata. As well, those sort of dolls that are sort of made to move in interesting ways. So all sorts of things. I'm also going to do a potted history of the Barbie doll, read through a sort of in an ideological way as well. That's extraordinary.
The history of anything that's in any way humanoid is always fascinating. We've one of the episodes I'm most proud of from our back catalogue is the one on the history of puppets.
Mm.
I'd go and have a look at that. It's absolutely brilliant. Really, really interesting. Puppets and or revolution and all sorts of using puppets to counteract the Nazi invasion, doing so in the mountains of Italy, I seem to remember. Really, really wonderful stuff. So, yeah, anything that does involve giant or tiny humans, enlarged or shrunken, is always fascinating why it was done and how it was represented. The age of them, James, you mentioned the Vikings. One of the places I often start when I'm doing a history of an unexpected episode, and I don't know where to begin, is the Victoria and Albert Museum. And they have a seriously old doll, 1300 BC.
Goodness me.
So, I mean, really, it's, 2 millennia before the Vikings. I'll just describe it here, but this is for the catalogue. Humanoid figure, painted wood, shaped like a paddle at the bottom. These are called paddle dolls. This is one of several. There is very little of its head left, merely a small rectangular block. Likewise, the hair, threads, strands and arms are missing. The rest of the body is sound, although the paintwork is faded and stained in parts. The body is shaped like a paddle. From the base upwards, about 3.25 centimetres, are painted small black dots. From there upwards to about 6.75 centimetres from the base are alternate black, white and red squares in a chequered pattern. The rest of the torso is painted with vertical bands of black and red herringbone patterns. The collar fans out radially with red painted lines. So it's really quite elaborate, this. On the back is further use of the black and red herringbone pattern to indicate diagonal straps from shoulders to waistband. From the waistband are 2 long panels that cross diagonally to each other, another horizontal band 6 centimetres from the base. The band has 2 diagonal panels with red and black lines painted down them. The base is decorated with 3 horizontal bands of black, red and black herringbone pattern. So the point I want to get across here is they don't just have a doll from that long ago, but it was immensely well decorated. And also, I love the fact that very little of its head left. And I think as an archaeologist, my previous career of an archaeologist, I loved the discovery of humanoid figures, particularly the ones that are not immediately, obviously human. And it gives you a real shock when you actually realise just what you're looking at, and it's an abstract interpretation of a human. And that's why I really like these paddle dolls. They're actually, they've been thought to present members of a female troupe of singers dedicated to the entertainment of a particular goddess called Hathor, who is the goddess of the sky, of women, fertility and love. So if you are interested in this ancient history of dolls, do just check out the Victoria and Albert Museum stick-in dolls or paddle dolls, and you'll have these wonderful, wonderful objects will come up. And interesting to think that people were buried with them. All sorts of questions as to why that might have been the case. And for you as well, James, you'd be interested in the link with a female troupe of singers.
Ooh, very fascinating, Samuel Willis. As ever, I too delved the V&A archives and came across some late 17th century dolls, Lord and Lady Clapham. So they're thought to have been made between 1690 and 1700 and belong to the Cockerell family, who are descendants of the diarist Samuel Pepys. And these are just two beautiful examples of dolls from this period that basically evoke the fashion trends from the period. And this was what I wanted to start off by talking about. I've been reading the most excellent book called Fashioning the Early Modern, Dress, Textiles and Innovation in Europe, 1500 to 1800, which is edited by the brilliant Evelyn Welsh, a brilliant historian in her own right. But also, as a slight footnote, she's also the mother of Florence Welsh, she of Florence and the Machine fame. Anyway, this book has a wonderful introduction, where it's a collection of essays, all sorts of interesting things for you to sort of dip into if you're interested in the history of textiles or the history of fashion. There's great stuff in here, including a wonderful opening chapter by the brilliant John Stiles called Fashion and Innovation in Early Modern Europe. But the very expansive introduction sort of opens up the whole sort of theme of fashion, and one of the things that it in the 18th century, 17th and 18th century, and one of the things that it's getting across, it tackles the idea of how do fashion and styles move around? How do you know about fashion? And one of the mechanisms that she talks about here is the use of mannequins and the development of mannequins in the early 18th century that come across from France, and then the trend spreads. And she outlines a sort of spoof of it, or a satire of the use of mannequins, in the Spectator publication. And they basically mimic or sort of tease this sort of French trend, and its attack on women's vanity, the desire of the English for French goods, and it centres on a sort of piece which describes the arrival of a jointed baby with latest Paris fashions in January 1712, and this is at the height of the war with France over the Spanish succession. And I quote, "I presume I need not inform the polite part of my readers that before our correspondence with France was unhappily interrupted by the war, our ladies had all their fashions from thence, which the milliners took great care to furnish them with by means of a jointed baby that came regularly over once a month, habited after the manner of the most eminent toasts in Paris." And then the spoof continues with Mr. Spectator himself basically commenting on with displeasure on the placement of a patch on the breast, refusing to look under her skirt. But what the shopkeeper explains to him is actually the doll is an automaton that would then be used to demonstrate all the postures of the French court. And while this is, you know, entirely fictional and a sort of humorous satirical account, there is already, even in the early 16th century, a practice of using mannequins in this way to display fashions. So if we have a look at the letter that Isabel d'Este wrote to her, Isabella d'Este's son. So, Jamie, just go back. This practice, though, was already widely in use by the early 16th century. And the son of Ilabella d'Este wrote to her, and I'll quote from this letter. "My illustrious and exalted lady," I write to my mother all the time like that, "my most reverend mother and Lady Monsignor de Moretta has told me that the king wishes my lady to send him a doll dressed in the fashions that suit you, of shirts, sleeves, undergarments, outer garments, dresses, headdresses and hairstyles that you wear, sending various headdresses styles that would better satisfy his majesty, for he intends to have some of these garments made to give to the women in France. Therefore would you be so kind to send this as soon as possible." And this brings us into sort of, you know, to actually thinking about the Lord and Lady Clapham figures of the late 17th century that I've already talked about in the Victorian Albert Museum in London. And these are exact sort of ideas, exact replicas of the kinds of things that would have been used at the time in order to display the kinds of fashions that people would have had. These aren't the kinds of body-sized mannequins that one sees in shops nowadays, but they are certainly, you know, smaller versions that would be sort of, that would be easy to sort of send around. And there are other examples of these kinds of, this kind of use to sort of demonstrate the latest fabrics, the latest fashions. In 1716, the Danish shopkeeper Madame Louise Rosse had a monopoly, and I'm reading here from the chapter, exhibiting the fashion dolls that were delivered monthly from Paris to her shop in Copenhagen. And another example from the playwright Carlo Goldoni describes how at the start of every season one may see at Venice in the Strada de Messeria a clothed figure which they call the Piavola of France. This is the prototype on which the ladies must model themselves, and any extravagance whatsoever is considered beautiful, provided it is found on this original. Venetian women are no less fond of variety than the ladies of France. The tailors, tailoresses, and dealers in fashion profit thereby. And if France does not supply a sufficiency of fashions, the artisans of Venice have the cunning to make some alterations. So there we are, Sam. Some brilliant examples of mannequins being used to convey fashion ideas. And I'll end with one 18th century advertisement which described Mrs. Hannah Teach, dressmaker at the top of Summer Street, Boston, is to be seen a mannequin in the latest fashion with the articles of dress, nightdresses and everything appertaining to women's attire. It has been brought from London by Captain White. Ladies who choose to see it may come and send for it. It is always ready to serve you. If you come, it will cost you 2 shillings, but if you send for it, 7 shillings. So there again, there's the idea that actually in a dressmaker is able to use that to purvey their wares.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm going to add to your wonderful phrase, plasticized swagger, the phrase jointed baby, which you used in that, which I've also never heard before. A jointed baby. Well, I like that a lot. I just want to talk a little bit about voodoo dolls. Much to add here.
Brilliant.
Just, the one thing you've got to bear in mind is that there's very little... Well, I mean, let's just. So what we're talking about here is a kind of a cursed doll. So, using a little humanoid figure, stabbing pins or whatever, and put curses on it, and then you hope that it'll affect the real human that you're using your doll to convey. It's a bit of a kind of a Hollywood, you know, fictional exaggerated version. There's very little proof or any kind of interest at all that it actually has much to do with the voodoo religion, practice, and culture. So although there may not be much evidence of it actually having a great significant position in the voodoo of Haiti or New Orleans, there is certainly historical evidence of these kind of cursed dolls being used throughout history, actually. One of the most interesting early depictions or descriptions of this comes from Plato in his Book of Laws. This is Book 11 of Laws. So he's writing around 400 BC, if you bear that in mind, as a kind of... As a placeholder figure for the period. That we now have expressly mentioned is that in which injury is done to bodies by bodies according to nature's laws. Distinct from this is the type which, by means of sorceries and incantations and spells, as they are called, not only convinces those who attempt to cause injury that they really can do so, but convinces also their victims that they certainly are being injured by those who possess the power of bewitchment. In respect of all such matters, it is neither easy to perceive what is the real truth, nor, if one does perceive it, is it easy to convince others. And it is futile to approach the souls of men who view one another with dark suspicion, if they happen to see images of moulded wax at doorways, or at points where three ways meet, or it may be at the tomb of some ancestor, to bid them make light of all such portents, when we ourselves hold no clear opinion concerning them. So that's Plato rather wonderfully relishing in the mysteries of life. It's one of the great things that Plato does. Now, I mean, that was very old, as I said, 400 or so BC, but this kind of idea of using dolls in this way does continue into early Christianity. And so this is the 5th century, so maybe in a millennia afterwards. You've got Sophronius, in his account of the miracles of St. Cyrus and St. John, describes a situation in which someone's made better. It's a medical recovery, you could probably describe it as, by the discovery of a doll. And he tells a story of Theophilus of Alexandria, and he is being rendered paraplegic, and he has uncontrollable pain in his limbs, and he believes this is all happening by enemies of his who are in league with the devil, which here, you know, bear it in mind, we're talking about this being a Christian practice. The fact that he believes it to have been done by people who are in league with the devil also suggests it being a non-Christian practice, which is very interesting that it appears in all sorts of different religions. Anyway, in dreams, this chap is told to hire a fisherman and go out to sea. The fishermen then do so. They catch what they discover to be a box. It's a box which is made of lead, and inside the box is a doll of Theophilus. And not only that, but in each limb is there a nail hammered through each limb. And then when they remove each nail, then the pain in his limbs then disappears. So I think it's really interesting, actually, because it's all to do with actually fear that this sort of magic actually works. And that fear of non-Christian practices does go on to characterise Christians' view of the pagan world for a while to come. And it's not just in this period it goes on. There's all sorts of evidence as well of people using kitchen witches, they're described as, or poppets, which is a similar tradition used in the British Isles. I think it's probably fair to say it's actually a Northern European practice. And the word poppet itself means child or doll in Middle English. So a long history there, James, both Christian world and non-Christian, and very ancient. So if you're thinking about voodoo dolls, whatever you do, don't get caught up on them being voodoo.
No, but however, if you search on Amazon, you can find several examples of modern day voodoo dolls, sort of humorous gifts. But I think it's still going on. I'm just on Amazon as we speak, and there's one for Boss. It says, don't get cross, get even. There's a revenge voodoo doll, and also one for an ex-lover. So it's amazing how these things sort of continue into the present. What I wanted to talk about in my final little segment was a history of Barbie. Barbie has been around for ages. And even my own daughters were, despite the fact that I didn't necessarily approve of Barbies, had Barbies. And it really managed to sort of really excite their imagination when they were young, without any of the sort of evil ideological connotations. So I'd like to talk then about the Barbie. Barbie was founded as a doll in 1959 in March, and in its first year, some 300,000 of these dolls were sold. And they were produced by the Mattel toy company, which was founded by Ruth Handler and her husband just after the Second World War in 1945. And then they introduce this doll based on the German doll, Bild Lilli. And one of the extraordinary things is how much it takes off. I mean, it's estimated that in 2020, Mattel sold, get this, Sam, $1.35 billion worth of Barbie dolls and accessories.
Whoa.
Which was the most extraordinary growth that they'd had. I mean, I imagine this is because of lockdown and parents wanting to buy dolls for their children to keep them entertained. This had grown from $950 million in 2017. I think what's interesting about the Barbie doll is thinking about it in historical terms, thinking about its impact on young children who have it. One of the things that's quite difficult to recover is how a child responds to a doll. And I think across history, we often see it from the perspective of the doll being produced, the ideology that's behind the doll, but actually the sort of the impact that a doll has on an individual child. I was struck recently by the arrival of Afghan refugee children into the United Kingdom. I think I talked about this the other week, and I was very struck by this young girl who couldn't speak English, is greeted by one of the volunteers and is handed a doll and is just so surprised that she's been given something and just hugs it to herself, you know. And you know, how as a historian do you recover that experience of that emotional experience and that bond with a doll? I think if we're thinking sort of more generally than that, though, you think about the impact of the Barbie doll. And, you know, is it something that is positive, that what it does is it has an impact on social values, it conveys characteristics of female independence, so actually it's quite good. It's quite aspirational, you know, in the sense that what you have is a sort of a relatively wealthy, leisured lifestyle with friends. I mean, and it's really part of that kind of, you know, American consumerist, capitalist sort of ideal that has been sort of developed not only through the doll, but the accessories And the paraphernalia that go around it, the sort of media franchise. So there are now films, television series, games, there's music. My own daughters were obsessed with Barbie movies when they were younger, sort of, you know, because all of their friends were into it. And I suppose to what extent does it have this, what impact has it had on children's imagination, and particularly young girls' imagination, you know, from its early days to now? And I think one of the things that is interesting is actually looking at how Barbie has evolved. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But what you see now is that there has been a response to the criticisms of, you know, Barbie being this, you know, a particular kind of body shape, an unrealistic body image for young girls, that it, you know, the size of the doll is tiny, you know, tiny waist, sort of, you know, sort of petite figure, that this sort of encourages sort of anorexia and eating disorders and all of those kinds of things. And actually, Mattel has responded to a lot of this. The size of Barbie's waist has grown. So it's much more, you know, realistic in size. And also the range of Barbies that you have has changed over time and has become much more inclusive and representative of ethnicity, of different sort of pursuits. So we have the astronaut, the surgeon, the Olympic athlete, the skier, the aerobics instructor, the rock star, the vet, the army officer, the Air Force pilot, the diplomat, the rap musician, even the presidential candidate, scuba diver, firefighter, dentist, all of these, you know, over 150 or so, you know, different kinds of Barbies. Now, of course, you know, this is to sort of widen the market and allow children to sort of purchase and want and consume. But also it's a way in which the doll is responding to pressure to become, you know, more representative. I suppose what that is, it's a sort of marketing embrace and sort of response to that. But I think if we have a look at the history of Barbie herself, the original Barbie was in 1959, as I said, that's her official birthday, and it is Barbie with red hair, earrings, lipstick on, powdered cheeks, and in what seems like a sort of striped swimsuit. And it's mimicking the sort of glamour of Hollywood sort of actresses at the time, people like Marilyn Monroe. We then sort of go through a really interesting sort of, you know, range of different Barbies. And apparently I was wrong earlier on, there were not just 150. My notes here are telling me that Barbie has had over 200 careers. She even went to the moon in 1965, before Neil Armstrong did. So she's done all sorts of things. We then have the introduction in the 1960s. In 1961, Barbie gets a boyfriend, Ken Carson. And Ken, sort of suddenly we have the, you know, that you're able to sort of pair her up with a mate, with a boyfriend. And then there is early feminist reaction to her, and you know, that she is basically a sex symbol. And then in 1963, they introduce a sort of slightly dowdier best friend, Midge, who's added to the family. And then she has a sister, Skipper Roberts, who sort of comes in. There are then celebrity Barbies, Twiggy, in 1967, the supermodel Twiggy, joins the family. And there are other sort of superstar Barbies, Cher, Audrey Hepburn. Would you think that J.K. Rowling as well is it? And then we then have the introduction of an African American and Latina Barbie. So, you know, racially Barbie is diversifying. The African American doll is introduced in 1968. The Latina Barbie in 1980. And also we have a proliferation of different international Barbies. Now, again, one could say that this is actually catering to a global market, which it presumably is, but also it is diversifying the range of the dolls. And then we go through, we've got an Andy Warhol painting Barbie, we've got, Barbie for President looks very suspiciously like a sort of, it's slightly before Hillary Clinton, way before Hillary Clinton, but a Barbie running for president in 1992. There's Barbie on the runway. There's even drag queen Barbie after that. There is also Ella, who is a chemo Barbie. So Barbie is sort of, representing, victims patients with cancer. That's introduced in 2014. So there's this idea that Barbie is diversifying. There's a new look. Barbie even goes historic. So there's a range of sort of inspiring women Barbies. And this is a whole new collection that's brought out in 2018. Amelia Earhart, Frida Kahlo, Katherine Johnson. So really, Barbie is, is very much, part of history, Sam. Not only representing Barbie. So there we are. A potted history of Barbie. Good, bad, lover, hater. We have a whole box full of them at home, unloved, unplayed with. But no doubt they have left an enormous mark on my daughters.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. It's a fascinating history. And you can go on and you can explore dolls' houses as well, which is a completely separate and fascinating subject. And if you are interested in that, do just Google the Queen Mary's Dolls' House, so early 20th century, which is a truly extraordinary relic. It was a super fancy doll's house which was made for the Queen and has contributions from over 1,500 of the finest craftsmen and authors and poets and manufacturers of the early 20th century. It really is an extraordinary thing, so do have a look at that. I hope you've enjoyed that episode on the history of dolls. We've got all sorts of wonderful stuff coming to you next week and soon. Anyway, coming up, the history of cousins is on its way, and I think we might do the history of leaves, James. So inspired was I by your idea for doing something on that in the last episode. Do please follow me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in the history of the sea, please check out my other podcast, the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on Twitter at James Dable. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Instagram and Facebook, and we have a lovely website, historiesoftheunexpected.com. And if you want to be a patron, head over to Patreon, where you can support what we are doing with anything that you can afford.
Yep, anything you could afford would be hugely appreciated. It'll help us change the way we get people to think about the past. That is our ultimate goal. Thanks very much for listening. As always, guys, cheerio. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.